This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Lost and Founder, a painfully honest field guide to the startup world. This is the author, Rand Fishkin. To my grandparents, Pauline and Seymour, my mom, Jillian, and my wife, Geraldine, your love and support were my first investors. Introduction. The Startup Cheat Code. Universal truths we learn by age 12. Never feed a mogwai after midnight. Breakfast cereal does taste better if you substitute chocolate milk. And, most relevant to our story, the first time you play a new video game, you'll suck. The controls are foreign. The game mechanics are inscrutable. Make it through level 1 and level 2 will undoubtedly get you. But that second time around, you'll do better. And if you play for a few hours or a few days, you'll start to feel the flow. Eventually, you're unstoppable, in the zone, a juggernaut of win, the ruler of your castle, though in this case, the castle is probably your parents' basement. But even if it's your first time playing, there's a way to jump ahead of the learning curve. Cheat codes. Starting a business works this same way. The first time you build a company, it's scary as hell. Accounting? Payroll? Customer acquisition? Recruiting? Hiring? Fundraising? People management? No wonder first-time founders, like first-time gamers, die on the first level. Customers won't pay. Employees quit. Your investors make your COO your boss, then fire you. You will very much want to retreat into a basement and play video games for several long hours, possibly years. The good news, there's a cheat code here too. In my third year as a first-time, what the hell am I doing, CEO? I got an email from a Seattle entrepreneur I deeply respected, inviting me to join a local group of startup movers and shakers at a local bar. When I arrived, I was introduced to a handful of people whose names I knew from the startup news websites and blogs I followed. These were founders and technologists I'd read about, but never thought I'd meet. Basically, the coolest nerds in my universe. I played it cool. We drank, we talked, well, they mostly talked, I mostly listened. What I heard shattered my long-held illusions about startup life. These men and women were scared, just like me. They were uncertain. They struggled. They felt fear. They needed help. Those who'd been through an experience gave advice and offered assistance to the first-timers. The longer we stayed and the more we drank, the more vulnerability emerged. No one pretended to have all the answers, but when someone had insight, they opened up. When I got home, I tipsily typed an email to myself with some of what we talked about. I stared at it, trying to figure out if it was possible to avoid the pitfalls, a way to not suck the first time around. Here are some of the more tactical takeaways I learned that night, apart from four Tom Collins's are one too many. Raising prices for your product every year, or two, and grandfathering in existing customers is a great way to increase loyalty and grow your profit margins. We did this several times over the next few years. It worked like a charm. If you want to raise money from an investor, ask for help with your business. If you want an investor to help with your business, ask for money. From later experiences, I can verify that yes, this totally works. Many voting rights for funded companies have some provision that gives special consideration to preferred shareholders. Usually these are the investors, but smart entrepreneurs know this and thus will buy a small amount of preferred shares in their own companies during a funding round, so they will also share these rights. The Hacker News website, news.ycombinator.com, has an algorithm that filters out high quantities of votes from a single geography. So, if you want to ask your friends to help upvote something to page one, make sure they're not all in the same city. Also, make friends in other cities. Recruiting for software engineers is best done directly by founders. Find people who look interesting, uncover a connection you have to them in your network, get an intro, meet for coffee, get them excited about your company, and if they're not interested, ask who they know who might be. Not one of the group's members had success with external recruiters, at least not in the early stages. Oh, and Craigslist still works way better than most of the other job sites, at least in Seattle. How did these entrepreneurs acquire this knowledge? How did they have answers to questions I didn't even know I should be asking? The answer? They had startup cheat codes. Sadly, it's not as easy as the Konami code. The hard way to earn those codes is experience. You struggle through a problem, follow conventional wisdom until you prove it's not working, make all sorts of mistakes, and then, eventually, stumble onto a solution that succeeds. It's agonizing, but sometimes it's the only path available. The cheat is to have connections to people, mentors, advisors, friends, family, partners, employees, who've been through the problems you're facing before and can give you a map out of the woods and onto a path that works. You need to be willing to listen. You need a network whose problems and solutions match. But when you can short-circuit the painful quagmire of stumbling through an issue alone, it's gold. That's one of the biggest things I've learned about startups. It's dangerous to go alone. You want people around you who've been through this before and are willing to openly share their experiences. That's why second and third-time entrepreneurs have such better track records than their first-time peers, and why investors are so much more likely to back a founder who's been through the game at least once before. This book is one really long cheat code. I wrote it so that you don't have to repeat the mistakes I've made, so you can leapfrog the wasted months, the wasted cash, and the heartache too many of us endure. So that if you don't live in a geography with lots of other startup founders, you can still get the inside scoop. To unlock these cheat codes, you'll need context, stories, data, and thorough explanations. And I won't just share the tactical tips and tricks. I have to include the ugly, heartbreaking realities too. If I held back out of fear or a desire to make myself or my company look better than it is, I'd be failing you. That's why this book is so transparent about the things founders don't normally discuss. Money, depression, layoffs, failure. I'll tell you how I turned down a life-changing acquisition and how I regret it to this day. Hell, I'll even read you the email. I'll walk through how we raised money and explore why it's so rarely the right move and why it may even have been wrong for us. And I'll show why so much of classic Silicon Valley startup advice is flat-out wrong, mangled by survivorship bias, and only applicable to a tiny subset of companies and founders, even though it's dispensed to everyone with one-size-fits-all uniformity. The next 17 chapters are here to dismantle the shady logic born from the oversimplified, opaque stories of what startup success looks like. Instead, I'll share real stories, show real numbers, and offer real solutions. How the Valley Fooled Us All. The aggrandized archetype of the startup founder is powerful and pervasive. These entrepreneurs pull themselves up from nothing and create jobs, wealth, and world-changing tech despite their meager beginnings. It's also total bullshit. University of California, Berkeley economists analyzed shared traits of entrepreneurs and found that, in reality, most come from backgrounds of wealth and privilege. I complain about having no friends as a kid, but let's be clear. I had a friggin' Nintendo game console in 1989. That's basically the child equivalent of a free Coke hookup in the 80s. But anyone can succeed in the gold rush of tech startups, right? That's the whole point, isn't it? Nope. Sorry. More BS. More than 75% of early-stage technology companies fail to return their investors' capital. Never mind make a profit, according to a Harvard Business School cohort analysis. If we look only at tech-centric, venture-backed startups, it's more than 90%. Even surviving the first few years was no guarantee of success. A full 50% of the companies still alive in year four went under. Founders are usually young, just out of school, yeah? Nope. The Kauffman Foundation found that most founders are between 35 and 44 years old, not the 20-something college dropouts epitomized by popular culture. If this data has you questioning the way you think about startups, good. It should. I hate these mythological stories, for a personal reason. I spent a decade pursuing this precise, vaunted myth of startup success and went off the rails. As a white Jew-ish American dude, I'm ethnically Jewish, 97% Ashkenazi according to 23andMe, but not religious, so bring on the bacon. I've enjoyed a life of relative wealth and privilege compared to 99% of the world. But I wasn't fated to or groomed to become a tech entrepreneur. I'm not a programmer. I didn't go to an Ivy League school or a computer science program. My company wasn't founded in Silicon Valley. When I started, I didn't know a single venture capitalist or any entrepreneurs who'd raised money. I was never recruited into the startup or technology world. Maybe the only correlation I've got with the vaunted startup founder myth is that I dropped out of college, mostly because I had a fight with my dad and he stopped paying my tuition. Does that count? Suffice it to say, I'm a pretty unlikely tech founder CEO. Yet somehow, remarkably, accidentally, that's exactly what I became. In 2001, I started working with my mom, Jillian, designing websites for small businesses in the shadow of Microsoft's suburban Seattle area campus. Side note, mom and son consultancy is probably the least likely startup combination in this field. It raised plenty of eyebrows along the way. After a while, I took to calling her by her first name in work contexts. That helped. The dot-com bust and my sorely lacking business acumen meant we struggled for years, but eventually, after trial and error, missteps and heartaches, tragedy and triumph, I found myself CEO of a burgeoning software company, complete with investors, employees, customers, and write-ups in TechCrunch. By 2017, my company, Moz, was a $45 million a year venture-backed business-to-business software provider, creating products for professionals who help their clients or teams with search engine optimization, SEO. In layman's terms, we make software for marketers. They use our tools to help websites rank well in Google's search engine. And as Google became one of the world's richest, most influential companies, our software rose to high demand. Moz is neither an overnight billion-dollar success story nor a tragic tale of failure. The technology and business press tend to cover companies on one side or the other of this pendulum, but it's my belief that for the majority of entrepreneurs and teams, there's a great deal to be learned from the highs and lows of a more middle-of-the-road startup lifecycle. Outliers like Facebook, on the wildly successful end of the spectrum, or Secret, on the opposite end, make for terrifically interesting shock pieces, but neither is willing to disclose enough or perhaps be self-reflective enough to provide great insight into the subjects that bring value to those who'd follow in their footsteps, or who try to avoid doing so. This book intends to do exactly that by tackling tough subjects through anecdotes, stats, and harsh self-inquiry. Admittedly, my perspective is biased by my experiences, my background, and my unique view of the startup world as an employee, a CEO, and a board member. I try to be as upfront as possible about all of that. I believe that to get the most from any singular experience, you need to know the author's journey and position. Given that perspective via this introduction, you can take my biases into account as we embark on this examination of startups and entrepreneurship. Moz is different from many of the most written about tech startups in a few ways I should mention. As a business-to-business company, our product is almost always marketed to and purchased by companies and consultants rather than directly by consumers. This is worth noting because the most visible and written about tech companies are usually consumer-facing, either in software, like Facebook or Google, or physical products or services like Tesla or Airbnb. Our products are self-service rather than sales-driven. This means anyone can, at any time, visit our website, enter their credit card, and get full access to our software without ever talking to or interacting with a person on our team. Because, let's be real, phone calls are terrifying. This approach has been historically uncommon in business-to-business, or B2B, primarily because sales were viewed as critical to forming relationships between businesses and a way to push through large, expensive, ongoing contracts. Today, with the rise of web-enabled delivery and a generation of business owners and professionals more comfortable with a hands-off, low-pressure sales approach, self-service B2B sales funnels are slowly on the rise, as evidenced by companies like Slack, SurveyMonkey, Dropbox, or MailChimp. Moz is creating and serving a new market, rather than disrupting an existing one. SEO software has been around since only the mid-2000s. We were one of the first providers, starting in 2007, to offer it via a web subscription versus downloadable desktop software, and one of the largest in our field, both by revenue and by customers. As of this writing, we aren't aware of any direct competitors who are many multiples of our size, any whose stock is publicly traded, or any who has massively more customers or revenue. But, though we have some outlying attributes, Moz does have many of the other features stereotypical to tech startups. We've raised funding from traditional venture capital firms, as of 2017, $29.1 million across three rounds. Nearly all of our revenue comes from software. We operate with relatively high gross margins, 75% and above. We employ very expensive, talented, highly in-demand engineers, product designers, marketers, and customer service folks. The average Moz salary is more than $100,000 a year, and with benefits and taxes, a new employee costs us about $145,000 a year. More than 70% of our costs come from the salaries and expenses of people on the team. We've fluctuated over the years from burning cash in attempts to grow faster versus staying profitable in order to limit risk. For example, from 2014 to 2016, we consumed almost $20 million. As of 2017, we were profitable again with more than $7 million in the bank. Since our founding in 2004, we've had some wild ups and downs. We've survived boom and bust cycles, raising and spending venture capital, making successful acquisitions and not-so-successful ones, hiring sprees and layoffs, new product launches and product retirements, and big changes in strategy. In 2014, after a particularly brutal period, I stepped aside as CEO and took a role as an individual contributor. As of this writing, I'm chairman of Moz's board of directors and an advisor to several of our product and marketing teams. I speak at more than 30 conferences a year and spend about 25% of my days on the road helping folks around the world gain a better understanding of how search engines and web marketing channels work. I still walk to the office from the apartment I share with my wife, Geraldine, run tests that Google wishes I wouldn't, try to be a force for transparency both internally and externally at Moz, and do my best not to beat myself up for the mistakes of the past. That last endeavor is the hardest. When I entered the startup world, I was predisposed to certain ideas about what it meant to be a CEO of a company like ours. Early stage, technology focused, rapid growth seeking, and successful only if we earned big returns for our shareholders and investors. We all read the coverage of other startups and watch the TV shows and news that purport to have windows into this reality. But years into my own journey, I had a head-shaking, wait a minute, this can't be right awakening. The media, the hype, the legends of how Silicon Valley startups work are just a carefully crafted model home. They're set pieces painted by interested parties for their own benefits, built to hide embarrassing flaws. None of it is real. You don't have to live, work, or start a company blinded the way I was to reality. That's why this book exists, and that's why it's organized into tactical chapters, each unearthing the sometimes strange, hard to comprehend, or rarely talked about truths of the startup world. These chapters start with the common mythos epitomized by a famous quote from a notable name in the technology world. You'll see the words of famous investors, wildly successful entrepreneurs, and esteemed authors, and piece by piece, see their falsehoods and false impressions dismantled. First, with stories of my own, and later through data, research, and analysis. Each chapter ends with ideas or tactics that have helped me, and sometimes others too, overcome the problems within. I don't pretend to have all the answers, not for a second, but I often have tactics that helped me out of a bind, and if they can help you, I'd kick myself for holding back. So get your controller, insert your cartridge. It's up, up, down, down, left, right, BA, select, and let's get started. Chapter 1. The truth shall set you free from a lot of shitstorms. You've got an interesting business, but we don't believe it will ever get past a few million dollars in revenue. From an anonymous investor I pitched in 2009. In 2005, my coworker Matt and I were working in a rundown shared office space above a noisy movie theater in Seattle when he walked in. A hairy, barrel-chested 40-something guy with gold chains, a mean grimace, and a stack of papers in a folder stared down at me. He asked, "Are you Rand Fishkin?" I was 25 years old, disoriented by his arrival, intimidated by his appearance and tone, and utterly panicked. I'm usually a terrible liar, so was taken aback by how quickly a response left my mouth. "Sorry, I don't think he's here." We exchanged a few more words, but I remembered none of them. My heart was pounding. I hated lying, but I also had no idea what might happen if I identified myself. Matt just put on his headphones and pretended to be engrossed in whatever website he was working on. When the extra from The Sopranos left, I called Jillian, president of our three-person firm, who also happens to be my mom. I told her about the unexpected visitor. She guessed he was a debt collector sent by one of the firms to whom a bank had sold our debt. Oh, right. The debt. The $500,000 we owed, in my name, to finance our struggling consulting business. 10 minutes after I returned to my apartment, actually Geraldine's apartment, I was unable to pay my half of the rent with my sometimes tiny, sometimes non-existent paychecks, and couldn't pass a credit check either. I heard a knock on the door. Assuming it was Geraldine carrying something she didn't want to put down to turn the key, I opened up without looking through the peephole. It was the debt collector. "Ha, gotcha," he said. I was mute. "You're pretty good, kid. I totally bought that act today." Scared senseless, I just stared at him. He handed me the folder of papers I'd seen in his hand earlier and said, "Rand Fishkin, you've been served." I couldn't even reach out to take them. He dropped them on the ground and walked away. Oops, I accidentally a startup. In the summer of 2000, I was 21, with a year of college to go at the University of Washington in Seattle. I'm one of those lucky kids whose parents paid his tuition so he could focus on his studies, not on work. That is, until I got into a fight with my dad, and he threatened to cut me off. I was too prideful and stubborn to back down, apologize, or reconcile, so for the next 2 quarters, I had to pay my own way. I worked part-time at the Wizards of the Coast Game Center, a giant arcade, gaming event center, and retail shop around the corner from campus. My $4.75-an-hour salary was supplemented by buying Pokemon cards with my employee discount and reselling them on eBay and Craigslist for a tidy profit. I designed and built a few websites on the side for some extra cash, and thankfully, in the early 2000s, college tuition hadn't yet skyrocketed past the point of absurdity. A full quarter, including books, only cost around $3,000, a sum I scraped together while still managing to have enough to go out to the movies, buy the occasional used video game, and pay the rent on my small shared apartment. But 2 classes away from graduating, I threw in the towel. Part of it was the cost, part of it was the lack of value I perceived from school, but a lot of it was because of a failed romantic relationship. Long distance plus breakup equals broken heart. I wish I could say entrepreneurship was the catalyst for dropping out, but the truth is the other way around. I wallowed in a little self-misery, watched a lot of X-Files reruns, and only then realized I needed something to do besides work retail. Web design was my path of least resistance. In 1981, my mom, Jillian, started a marketing consultancy in Seattle, helping small businesses with their logos, yellow page ads, brochures, and other print and advertising materials. In the late 1990s, her clients started asking for websites, and she recruited me to learn FrontPage, Dreamweaver, and HTML so I could help out. I liked the work and the extra money, and when I told my mom I wanted to work with her full-time and not go back to college, she obliged. Over the summer of 2001, we dreamed big. Seattle's tech scene was booming in Microsoft's backyard. Startups like Amazon, Cosmo, and HomeGrocer dominated the local news. Everyone was switching from slow dial-up modems to high-speed broadband. We thought we had an amazing opportunity to design sites for local businesses that needed a presence on the soon-to-be ubiquitous internet. When the dot-com crash hit, I barely noticed. Our clients still needed websites, and I didn't pay much attention to the falling prices, the late payments, or the commoditization of web design. For the next 3 years, we struggled against increasing competition, pervasive doubt about the web's future, the challenges of getting our clients to pay their bills on time, and worst of all, our own foolish beliefs about what would help our company grow. We were trying to sell our services in a crowded marketplace without a competitive differentiator. We wasted money on advertising that didn't bring in business. We leased high-price office space, convinced that an impressive building would help us close deals. We hired contractors and employees who didn't work out. We rented booth space at events that didn't even pay for themselves. And worst of all, we went into debt to do it. When I started working with my mom, she had a small amount of debt on the business, less than $20,000 in total. But 3 years later, we'd amassed an additional $100,000 of debt, much of it from the aforementioned missteps. The great thing about a consulting business is supposed to be the low capital requirements. Smart operators often make their consultancies profitable from day one. We went the other direction. And in 2004, after we failed to secure yet another client project we thought could put us on the path to success, we defaulted. It's hard today to imagine the pre-2008 financial crisis world of personal debt, where banks would extend loans of $50,000 to $100,000 to a college dropout with a tiny salary. At the time, credit card offers arrived almost weekly, promising $10,000 limits that would quickly rise to $15,000 or $20,000. Lending institutions were happy to offer us lines of credit and equipment loans, despite our meager track record and non-existent collateral. Promotional interest rates in the under 2% range were available for the first 2 or 3 years of an account. Seduced by these offers and in desperate need of cash just to make payroll and rent for three people, we went whole hog, racking up a balance that eventually came back to bite us. We took out loans and put them in my name because I had, at the time, nothing to lose. My mom had her and my dad's assets on the line. They owned not only their home in Seattle suburbs, but my grandmother's house in Connecticut as well, which could have also been on the chopping block as collateral. So it was my Social Security number and my signature on the loans, something that at the time didn't really scare me. Defaulting on these loans never really crossed my mind. Two of the most memorable days in my early career came that fall of 2004. The first was on a Sunday. Jillian had told me and Matt, my friend and our programmer, that we'd no longer be able to afford the rent at our pricey high-rise office tower. Moving out was our only option. We found a tiny, shared office space in a rundown part of Seattle, above an old movie theater, for only a few $100 a month, versus the $2,000 plus that we had been paying. But we'd need to break our lease. That meant the landlord could potentially hold our equipment, including our computers, desks, chairs, and furniture, as collateral. We had to get it out of the tower and over to the new space fast, without anyone from the building noticing. This part's straight out of a movie. Matt and I recruited a pair of friends, Marshall and Todd, a couple with two sets of big arms, strong backs, and a spacious truck, to whom we promised dinner, and quietly entered the building via the loading garage. We were halfway through loading up when the tower's security guard arrived. Cue heart falling into stomach. After a brief, tense discussion on either side of our locked office door, we had the guard make a phone call to Jillian. Somehow, she convinced him to let us finish moving some of the items, but we had to leave a good deal behind to make it seem like we weren't actually moving out, but rather moving some things around. With our pulses racing, we took Todd's half-full truck out of the loading dock and across Lake Washington to our new, tiny, bare-bones but safe-from-seizure office. We'd sacrificed a good dozen pieces of unwieldy office furniture and some cheap supplies, but felt lucky just to make it out with our computers and essentials. The next week, the company my mom had run for 23 years officially closed, and we started a new business under a new name. But though we'd moved and changed our name, we were far from starting fresh. A couple of months later, that gold chain debt collector showed up, and I called my mom in a panic. Even though the debt was being used for business purposes, the creditors would be coming after me personally because it was my signature and my social security number on the applications. Jillian told me she'd try to take care of it. That was the first day I truly understood that most of the money our company owed was actually money I owed personally. It made sense. If Jillian had used her name and her credit to take out even more of those equipment loans and low-interest credit cards, she and my dad could be held liable for repayment, and she already had some debt of her own. They could lose their assets and be forced into bankruptcy. My grandmother could lose her house. That evening, walking home from work, I started processing our nerve-wracking situation and my role in creating it. I'd willfully chosen to ignore and not ask questions about the financial problems we were in. Ostensibly so I could concentrate on my part of the work, but in honesty, because I didn't want to deal with it. My mom could handle it. That was her job, right? I was just the web design guy. That's what I told myself. But slowly, I came around to the idea that sticking my head in the sand about our debt in the hopes it would go away was an untenable path. When you're in debt to the truth, the interest rate sucks. Considering the onslaught of final notice letters, threatening phone calls, and the visit from gold chains and chest hair guy, let's go with Rocco, as he already fit every other debt collector stereotype, the logical move would have been to declare bankruptcy. Most of the debt was in my name, a little was in Jillian's, and because we had defaulted on the bigger chunks in my name, the black marks I was racking up on my credit report were having a similar effect to a bankruptcy. As of this writing, my creditworthiness is still in the toilet. But we had another impediment. During the 4 years we built up debt, we'd been lying. We'd never told my dad, Scott, to whom my mom was and remains married, that we had any financial problems, any outstanding loans, or any debt collectors breathing down our necks. We both feared, rightly or wrongly, that if he found out, he'd divorce my mom and break up our family. It sounds too dysfunctional to be real, but this lie of omission wasn't without precedent. Growing up, my parents lied to each other all the time, mostly about little stuff, or at least those are the only things I knew about. Dad would say, "Don't tell your mom we did this," or "If anyone asks, tell them you're only 7 years old," or "We're promised a discount," or "We're told by the staff it was okay." Mom would say, "If your father asks, tell him we used a coupon," or "had to because of your school," or "went here on behalf of a client." These were mostly innocent lies, crafted in order to prevent an altercation and keep relationships smooth. As an adult, reflecting on these memories makes me realize how profoundly unhealthy the dynamic between my parents was, but as a child and teenager, it made reasonable sense. The goal was to limit anyone getting angry or feeling hurt or left out or ignored. We were lying to keep the peace and maintain the veneer of a happy family unit. That debt, however, was a much bigger lie than anything I'd ever been part of. I remember Geraldine and I talking about it at the time and for years after. We wondered how my mom could stand to be around my dad day after day, holding in this giant secret, rushing to get home before him so she could shred any potentially incriminating mail, pretending that the debt collection calls were wrong numbers, keeping up the appearance that things were fine at work, even bringing home an occasional paycheck to make him think things were okay when we probably should have used that money to stave off the next bank that might sell our debt to collections. Jillian, ostensibly to keep us from worrying and to help us focus on our tasks, kept some of the details and progress of our struggle against debt hidden from me at the time. It wasn't until years later that I learned how she managed to dodge some of the worst debt collectors by proactively calling the issuers of the debt. Washington Mutual, Bank of America, Chase, Wells Fargo. Sharing the details of our situation and offering a smaller sum than what was owed in exchange for the creditor writing off the debt rather than selling to collections. Because a collections agency would typically pay the debt holder 5 to 10% of the actual amount owed, then try to collect the full amount and profit from the delta, my mom's tactic was often successful. While my credit report took the brunt of our debt problems, Jillian bore the lion's share of the stress. She'd always taken care of our finances and transactions. Despite having more than half a dozen credit accounts with various companies, I never even looked at the invoices. I passed them to my mom and went back to designing websites. I knew things were bad, but I rarely asked for updates. I just went about my work, hoping beyond hope that we could somehow land enough contracts and make enough money to pay back what we owed. Later, I'd hear stories of other small businesses and startups that faced similar situations. Although I wish it were true that co-founders and family business owners and small teams were always honest with one another, that's often not the case. Tinder grew to dominate the world of online dating apps, but behind the scenes, co-founder strife, political struggles, and outright sexism led to lawsuits, stunted growth, and power struggles. Zipcar, one of the fastest-growing players in alternative transportation, lost both its co-founders over years of politicking, infighting, and fundraising struggles. Twitter famously lost nearly all of its founding team. Facebook's co-founder Eduardo Saverin helped write a movie, The Social Network released 2010, about his ouster. Despite these all-too-common conflicts, many businesses don't collapse. They find ways of coping, carrying on, and working through or around poor communication, dishonesty, and dozens of other challenging problems people in high-stakes relationships face. And that's what we did. Transparency is hard, but it works. There will never be a shortage of justifications for why you believe hiding the truth is the right path. You're worried about hurting someone's feelings. You're afraid if your customers find out about a problem, they'll leave your service forever. You're convinced that you're actually protecting your executive team from stress by redacting details of your investor meetings. You believe the competition probably has engineers idly waiting for some sign of how you've built your amazing technology so they can instantly replicate it and launch before you have the chance. So you keep secrets. You distort the truth. You tell a few lies. And worst, you think you can get away with it. Later, when reality comes crashing down, as it always does, you lose the faith of your team members or your audience, your investors or your customers. But you justify it by telling yourself, if things had only gone another way, no one would have even found out, and everything would have been fine. I have to assume that's what Travis Kalanick thought about his visits to Korean escort parlors with the Uber executive team. And what Facebook thought about testing whether showing particular posts could influence people's moods. It's surely what Steve Ballmer believed about his infamous abusive tantrums at Microsoft leadership meetings. And it's undoubtedly why Tinder's CEO thought he could sexually harass and bully co-founder Whitney Wolf. When people believe they can hide the truth, many of the incentives inhibiting bad behavior fall apart. Every founder, every investor, and certainly every employee I've ever talked to in the startup world has stories about the secrets that eventually got out, costing trust, harming relationships, and often affecting revenue and growth too. But there's another way. Transparency. Transparency is making the choice to reveal even the most uncomfortable truths with relentless candor. Transparency isn't the same as honesty. Honesty is saying only things that are true. Many founders and startup teams are honest in that they don't directly lie. But transparency requires digging deep to find and expose what others would normally leave unsaid and refusing to take the easy, quiet road. It's tackling the conversations that make your stomach turn and your voice get caught in your throat. And like nearly everything in the world of startups, swallowing the bitter pill now is vastly superior to letting the disease of opacity fester. If there's an underperforming person on your team, it's easy to ignore him for a while and hope his manager either helps him improve or fires him. It's much harder and more uncomfortable to thoughtfully process why you're unhappy with him, document instances of unwanted behavior, have a direct conversation with the team member, and, if necessary, coach him or work to find mentorship or coaching or classes, whatever it takes to give him the tools to get better if he has the desire. It could still end up that you or his manager may have to ultimately fire him. That's the thing with transparency. Sometimes the outcome is the same, but how you got there and the downside risk is remarkably different. Say you're 6 months away from layoffs given your current revenue, expenses, and projections. You can be honest by simply remaining silent and imploring your team to improve the growth rate. Or you can be transparent by sharing your financials and your projections and explaining exactly what you need to do between now and month 6 to avoid cutting the team. 9 out of 10 leadership teams won't share that information. They'll fear, perhaps rightly, that team members might start looking for new jobs or leak numbers to the press. But what happens when those layoffs hit? Yeah, your team will stop trusting you. They'll no longer believe that things are going fine when you say so. They'll always be looking for signs that the next crisis is around the corner. Those team members you hoped wouldn't look for new jobs, trust me, they're far less likely to stay than if you'd been upfront. Transparency's harder at first, and it feels especially painful when it reveals your mistakes or challenges the image you've crafted for your team or customers. Yet, it's immensely powerful, and it has an almost unbelievably positive impact on everyone around you. Kim Scott, in her book Radical Candor, frames this concept in terms of a matrix. She outlines one of the most important things to remember when it comes to transparency. You need to balance it with empathy. If I tell you I hate your haircut, I'm being transparent. I'm also being an asshole. If your funding discussions are not going well, it's easy to hold out hope, tell your team you're still in the process, and only if or when the last investor backs out or the money in the bank runs dry do you let everyone know that cost-cutting and layoffs are happening. Far more uncomfortable, but vastly more transparent, is to give regular status updates on the fundraising process internally so employees and executives know precisely what investors are saying, why the pitch isn't working, and where the business metrics are perceived to be weak, and can then anticipate a realistic future and potentially contribute to a better result. It may feel like telling your team is admitting weakness and defeat, but in fact, you'll build camaraderie, support, and a powerful incentive to do remarkable work. I've been blown away, time and again, by the ability that bad news has to catalyze great effort and remarkable results. But I can't do that. My team will freak out. You'd be surprised at how people rise to a challenge once they know there is a challenge. And don't kid yourself. You may think you're keeping them safe by keeping them in the dark, but some distorted version of the truth always leaks. Misinformation stokes fear and resentment in your team. That's never good for business or for anyone's well-being. You need your team's trust, not just in that one moment when fundraising's going poorly or growth has stalled, but in the long term. Even after people leave, what they say about you and your trustworthiness will affect basic business functions like recruiting, sales, branding, and biz dev for decades to come. The most meaningful benefit transparency brings might be its forcing function for deliberately ethical, rational behavior. As CEO, I'd often tell my executives and board that every email should be written and every conversation conducted as though it will one day be leaked. We should be proud, not embarrassed, by what and how we communicate, even when the doors are closed. There are good reasons for privacy. To avoid shaming an employee for a mistake or to enable discussion about private, personal, or professional issues, among others. But people change their behavior for the better when they assume their peers, their reports, and their leadership will get to see or hear the full story. Transparency can't just be a tactic, though. It has to be a core value that's consistently followed. If you openly share some things but hide others, credibility will suffer. Your team will always wonder what you're not sharing. Your customers, your investors, the press, whomever you interact with, will be trained to mistrust you. A reputation for caginess lasts a long time and follows you across companies and geographies. When we adopted transparency as a core value at Moz, it wasn't always easy, and we didn't always live up to the ideal. But more than any other aspect of the company, transparency and the trustworthiness it instilled in our team, our community, and our customers built the company's legacy. We shared our financials online, just as I have in this book. We wrote about our product struggles, our fundraising failures, our most difficult internal conversations, our strategy. We were called crazy and foolish for oversharing so much about the mechanics of the business. But we also became trusted, and especially because the field of SEO and the broader world of tech startups are so often impenetrably secretive, it paid off. Early in my career, I was deeply afraid of being transparent. I feared if our customers knew the truth about our tiny operation or about my age and inexperience, they wouldn't want to work with us. Of course, when we signed a new client, inevitably we'd meet, or they'd search for me and find those things out anyway. I was scared like hell to admit I didn't know how some aspect of HTML worked, but by faking it, I outed my lack of knowledge even more blatantly. My mom and I covering up our debts and our missteps, hiding that risk from my dad, it only caused more stress and fear. Had we been honest from the start, he could have helped, could have saved us the hundreds of thousands in interest penalties we ended up owing. Instead, we created a nightmare of secrecy that nearly ended in professional and personal disaster. Of course, years later, he did learn the truth. I heard about it from my younger brother, Evan, who told the story this way. Dad found out about the debt. Mom tried to play it off, but he found out. I went to my room and put on headphones, but he yelled so loud the house was shaking. My only consolation, my dad and I weren't speaking at the time. We've probably had 3 conversations in the last 7 years. Secrets, lies, opacity, they tear families apart just as surely as they do startups. My credit still sucks. My relationship with my parents remains rough. But I don't get any more unexpected visits from debt collectors who look like they could bench press me. At least I can put that in the win column. If we'd been transparent from the start, I believe we'd be in a different, better place today. The only solace is that this lesson, hard won through regret and carried forward in my personal and professional life, helped, over the next decade, to make Moz into something truly special. If you ask me why I'm so open, so bluntly honest about things that the startup ecosystem and business culture usually urge us to keep silent, this is why. I'm done with the pain of secrecy, happy to trade it for the challenges transparency brings. Chapter 2. Why the startup world hates on services and why you shouldn't. Consulting is dancing with the devil as you pursue your dreams and try to pay the bills. I believe that it is near impossible to build a successful software product while maintaining a services business. That's Giff Constable, 2010. The Moz story should have ended with bankruptcy, failure, my dad shutting down the operation, me getting beaten up by Rocco the debt collector. How is it that 13 years later, we're a 155-employee, $45 million a year software business? Unbelievably enough, a side project that turned into a consulting business saved the day. The experts in the startup world will tell you that services and consulting are a waste of time. Fortunately, I hadn't yet heard that advice. When I started working at my mom's company, our business model was exclusively service-based. Many small businesses start this way. We did projects as diverse as business card design, website usability consulting, e-commerce implementation, print media ad design. Yep, like the ones in magazines and newspapers. My high school yearbook layout skills came in real handy. And of course, search engine optimization. The services model has some unique advantages and some frustrating drawbacks. On the plus side, costs are supposed to be low. You need to spend money only when you have client projects covering your outlays. Your work can be highly customized, which makes it easier to sell to disparate customers with little in common, versus the one-size-fits-all model of a product-focused company. The downside is that it's very hard to scale. The 100th client to whom you provide services needs just as much time, energy, and work as the 5th client. Granted, you may gain some efficiencies, but it's nothing like the scale a product-based business can achieve. We were never particularly strategic about changing our business model or thinking of ourselves as something bigger than a niche consulting firm. When, in 2002, Geraldine, yes, we dated a long, long time before getting married, asked me what I hoped Moz might become, I laid out a dream for a consulting firm with 15 to 20 employees, a nice client list, a healthy profit margin of 20 to 30%, and some beautiful offices. I hoped that in 5 to 10 years, we could become that company. A couple of years later, I'd split my time between SEO work for our clients and hours chatting away on the SEO forums with like-minded practitioners around the world, trying to learn more about the practice. But I wasn't satisfied with the limited options for starting and replying to threads on other people's sites. I wanted my own platform and the freedom to publish my own way. So I spent a few nights coding up a blogging system in Dreamweaver. This was in the days before plug-and-play blog software like WordPress was popular. And in October 2004, launched SEOMoz.org. People ask about the name a lot. The attempted pronunciations are usually delightful. For those of you wondering, it's SEOMoz. The name Moz was a reflection of my admiration for other Moz-named projects on the web. The well-known at the time Open Directory project, DMoz. The free restaurant and recipe website, ChefMoz. And the open-source music discovery site, MusicMoz.org. All of these names drew inspiration from the nonprofit Mozilla Foundation, itself a portmanteau for Mosaic Killer, Mosaic being the very first World Wide Web browser, and Mozilla aiming to displace it with a free, open-source browser of its own. My hope was to build a similarly open-source, free, authoritative resource for the world of SEO and search engines. I'd registered it as a .org, redirecting the domain SEOMoz.com to SEOMoz.org to help communicate that a non-commercial focus was intended. A savvy advisor teased me about the .org domain extension. "Are you in the business of being noble?" he asked. I laughed. I didn't know I was in the business of being anything. The blog was a first step, built in my off hours as a passion project with the goal of learning and sharing more about the weird world of ranking websites in the search engines. At the time, information about search engine operations and SEO practices was immensely hard to come by. So I enlisted help of the only kind I could afford, family. My grandfather, Seymour, and I spent days poring over patent applications by Google and Yahoo. We read technical papers from conferences on information retrieval, the science behind search engines. He taught me how PageRank, Google's famous link-based algorithm, worked. The iterations required to get graph convergence, why a dampening factor existed, how new links on a page could siphon PageRank from the existing links, etc. His mathematics and engineering background was invaluable, and we turned a number of our technical paper review sessions into blog posts and content pieces for the SEOMoz website. He and my grandmother also get co-credit for helping potty train me and teaching me to ride a bike. Point is, I owe them a lot. Thanks, Mama and Papa. As is true for many startups, the idea or business we eventually pursued came from a wholly unexpected place. That blog became a bootloader for the business, exposing the brand to a vast array of serendipitous experiences that led us to our eventual path. Today, it might be called content marketing, but when I was writing, it was simply passion for sharing, a youthful craving for attention, and a hatred of the secrets Google kept that drove those nightly posts. In the summer of 2005, I got an email from a reporter with Newsweek magazine, Brad Stone, who later went on to the New York Times and then Bloomberg Businessweek, who wanted to interview us for a potential story on the world of SEO. I was thrilled and hopeful at the possibility of press coverage. Although we were gaining in popularity with search industry insiders, we were still hamstrung by debt. We had plenty of work from a handful of clients, but needed to keep our expenses extremely low. Jillian had stopped taking a salary entirely. My coworker Matt and I were taking home a paltry $1,600 a month each. The $1,000 I spent earlier that year on a Toronto speaking gig was a big drain. That autumn, Brad flew to Seattle for a visit to our cramped office above the movie theater. I remember being deeply embarrassed about our dingy space and the smell of popcorn that wafted up. But it didn't seem to matter to Brad. He was writing a story about the practice of SEO, something that almost no mainstream media outlet had previously covered, and wanted to feature SEO Moz in the piece. I don't think he cared one iota about the size or aesthetics of our office with its flickering fluorescent lights or that weird stain on the carpet where we were pretty sure a raccoon had given birth. In December 2005, Brad emailed to let us know that the following week, Newsweek would be publishing a multi-page article, including a large photo of me and my mom. I was thrilled. Then I panicked. What if tens or hundreds of thousands of people visit and want to learn about SEO? The blog is too focused on insiders, and it won't be accessible to all these newcomers. They'll go search for SEO information somewhere else. I'd squandered an opportunity that didn't even exist yet. That week, I poured dozens of hours into a new project I called The Beginner's Guide to SEO. It remains one of the most productive freakouts I've ever had. The result was a giant document, almost a novella in length, detailing the many aspects of search engine optimization. How to do keyword research and discover what your customers are entering into the search engines. How to create content people and engines will both appreciate. How to identify problems or issues that could hinder search engines from effectively crawling and indexing your site. How to earn links and attention. The whole SEO shebang. Matt thought I was a madman. I barely made it into the office. I spent most days at home relentlessly trying to finish the guide. I even let some client work slip. When my tome was at last complete, Matt used his design skills to polish it up, and we posted the nearly 40-page guide on SEO Moz's website. We put a message on our homepage, welcoming visitors we hoped would see us in Newsweek, directing them to the beginner's guide if they wanted to learn more about SEO. Then, we waited. The article came out online first, on December 11th, 2015. Then it was in the print edition a week later, on December 18th. Home delivery was somewhere in between. And the traffic bump we saw to SEO Moz across a two-week period surrounding it accounted for, based on our analytics, fewer than 5,000 new visitors. Considering we normally received 1,000 daily visitors, the article had been merely a small bump. A far cry from the hyper-growth accelerant we'd hoped for. But that Newsweek piece helped us in an indirect way. The week prior, on December 6th, we'd posted the Beginner's Guide to SEO in anticipation of the Newsweek article. Sometime on December 7th, the popular technology news website Slashdot put the piece on its homepage, sending more than 35,000 visitors to SEO Moz in the first 24 hours. Dozens of other blogs and websites followed suit, sending huge amounts of traffic and attention our way. Taken together, the coverage of the Beginner's Guide dwarfed the traffic and press value from the Newsweek piece. My panic about how to teach Newsweek readers about SEO ended up as a far more effective catapult for SEO Moz's blog and brand than the audience for whom I'd written it. That piece of content, built to help serve a handful of magazine readers, transformed us from a niche, industry insider blog to one of the most recognized brands in the SEO space, and brought us the clients we so desperately needed to survive. A few speaking engagements later, we were working with companies like eBay,